From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The crisis of inequality in the United States is so serious that now even President Joe Biden is claiming that, quote, it's time to build our economy from the bottom up and from the middle out, not the top down. In a recent speech promoting his American Jobs plan, Biden said, I'm proposing a plan for the nation that rewards work, not just rewards wealth. In admitting that our current system rewards wealth, Biden revealed what American financial and political elites have known for decades, that we don't live in a meritocracy. We live in a nation where you have to be rich to get richer. My next guest has written a book about these wealth hoarders, as he calls them. Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. He's written numerous books, including 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, and Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes a Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. He's written numerous reports about the billionaire wealth during the pandemic, which we've had him on our show to discuss. And he now joins me once more to talk about his latest book, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Welcome back, Chuck.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to your book, let's talk about the American Jobs Act, which is Biden's next ambitious plan after the American Rescue Plan. Just the way in which he's talking about this plan seems significantly different, obviously, from Republicans, but really even recent Democratic presidents who have long, unfortunately, relied on things like tax credits to try to infuse, you know, money into the bottom part of society. Biden is sort of embracing, at least in writing, paying lip service to a sort of big spending FDR-like approach to rebuilding the economy. Is this a good sign?
Yeah, I think it's a good sign. He's basically saying, look, we need to do a big, bold expenditure. We need to make major investments in infrastructure and climate mitigation. And we should pay for it, not by giving more tax breaks and incentives for the rich to move their money and invest it, but by closing the loopholes that corporations have been using for the last several decades, and even the ways in which they kind of use corporate taxes and shell games that ultimately move jobs overseas. So he's also saying we're going to pay for this big public infrastructure, government programs, by closing corporate tax loopholes, which is terrific.
And just basically putting a lot of money into job creation, which is also something that's unfortunately been quite an anathema to see the government as a job creator. I don't know if you can trace it back to Reagan, where this real reluctance to see the government as employer has unfortunately coincided with how we've seen rising inequality, right?
The policy since the Reagan years was, if you want to get something done on a public policy level, you give private sector and rich individuals and companies tax breaks so they do the right thing. In this case, they're saying government has a direct role in public expenditures and driving the projects. I think it's an important shift.
And that's a sort of philosophical shift, if you will. And then you have progressives among Democrats who are saying $2 trillion is great, but it's not nearly enough. We need $10 trillion over 10 years. We're the richest country in the world. The climate crisis is so real and so urgent that we need to go even bigger. And that push from the left hopefully can only help, right?
Yeah, and I think of this as the next train down the station. It's still bigger than a lot of expenditures, but it is not, as you say, it's not up to scale to retrofit every public building, to kind of build the real green infrastructure we need. We are talking tens, if not 20s of trillions of dollars. And we have to come back to the fact that that money exists. That money is in our society. It's in the hands of private wealthy individuals largely. I think President Biden is making a tactical decision. Okay, this is the next bite that I think the current political system can handle. But our job is to keep saying, no, it has to be bigger, because it does.
So let's talk about those wealthy individuals that you just referenced. The Wealth Hoarders is the title of your new book. And you've written a book in the past about how you were born into the 1% and chose a very different path than most people who are born into wealth. And that's also where you open your book, The Wealth Hoarders. Your first chapter is called The Money River, which those who are born into wealth eventually realize, if not realize right away, is something that basically helps them retain and build on their existing wealth. What is the money river?
Well, in a way, the money river is the secret way in which the wealthy stay wealthy. I had a front row seat growing up to the fact that there's sort of this group of trusted advisors, tax attorneys and accountants and wealth managers who are hired by wealthy families to sort of help them protect, preserve, and expand their wealth. And, Kurt Vonnegut actually writes in a wonderful novel, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, about this sort of mythological money river, which is, the secrets of the money river are what the wealthy know and what they hire their helpers to protect. And I kind of use that image because there is this whole industry now of people who are about helping the wealthy become dynasties and protect their wealth.
And then you write about the Blue Hippo Swindle, which is another prelude to your book, which I confess I was shocked by. I had not heard about this. This was basically how one person or corporation generated wealth, not doing it the way that you sort of theoretically expect to do it, but basically by swindling large numbers of people. Tell me this shocking story.
Well, this hidden wealth problem isn't simply related to tax avoidance. It's another way in which the wealthy avoid accountability. So there's a grifter who started a company called Blue Hippo. He ran these television ads late at night promising that, you call this 800 number, we'll get you a computer. You just make a few payments every month. So people would call up, they would get their bank account information, and they'd take out $40 a week, and weeks and months would go by and these people wouldn't get their computers. And what they found, it was a complete scam. And the scammer still walks free today. He has a house in Florida. He's got a Facebook account. And the reason he does that is because he created these asset protection trusts in the Cook's Island. He went to lawyers and they helped him create a whole way to siphon money out of the country and keep it from claimants. And so people have sued him. The federal government has sued him. The state of Maryland has sued him. And they've never gotten back a dime after $14, $15 million of wealth extraction, mostly from working people who are just trying to buy a computer. So that's another reason why we should care about this hidden wealth system. It's not just a way the rich avoid taxes. It's also how grifters and deadbeats basically avoid their responsibilities.
And then you write about Angola, a country that is incredibly rich in resources and incredibly poor in cash and incredibly unequal in cash, as another example of how wealthy elites basically break the rules to enrich themselves. Why Angola? I mean, you've written about inequality in the United States. Why do you bring Angola into the equation?
Well, it's just another dimension of wealth hiding. So what we see all across the world is wealthy elites in mineral-rich countries plunder and steal from their own people, and then they siphon the money out, usually with the help of, again, this international wealth-hiding industry, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Boston Consulting Group, McKinsey and other consultants were all involved in helping the wealthiest woman in Africa, Isabel de Sotos, siphon about $2 billion out of Angola. So what connects all three of these stories is, Jeff Winters and other sociologists call a wealth defense industry. It's an industry that basically enables this wealth hijacking to occur.
We've recently learned about how the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, the government agency that is tasked with ensuring that taxes are collected properly, has been defunded so much over the years that they now spend the majority of their effort ensuring that the middle class pays its fair share in taxes, and have basically stopped enforcing properly the taxation of the very wealthy, which I assume is one of the many, many ways in which the wealth hoarders help keep their money out of the hands of the US government. There are stories every other day of companies that have been found to be hiding wealth offshore. So let's talk about how and where wealthy elites in this country hide their wealth so that it doesn't basically steal from the government.
Yeah, I mean, part of the dynamic is you have these wealthy individuals, and I'm really talking about people with like $30 million or more who have the ability to hire professional help to help them build their dynasties, sequester wealth. And I think that, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would have talked a lot more about Swiss bank accounts and the offshore system. But what we're learning actually is a lot of the super wealthy are hiding their money here in the United States. And because the rest of the world started to crack down and require greater transparency, global billionaires from around the world are bringing their wealth here to the United States, and they're parking it in luxury real estate, and they're getting shell companies in Delaware that where they can hide their identity, or they're creating what we call a dynasty trust in South Dakota, which is a trust that lives for centuries and sequesters money away from taxation. So there's a bunch of tools that this wealth defense industry uses to sort of mask who owns the money and keep the tax authorities or keep lawyers and litigants away from the treasure.
So you use this term, the wealth defense industry, that you say works as agents of inequality. This is not something that we hear, politicians talking about. Is this something that is just now emerging into view in terms of how the wealthy who have millions to spare to hide their billions of dollars. It seems a sort of a new method of theft.
Yeah, it's not new. It goes back. If you think the wealthy families have always had their financial courtiers. When John D. Rockefeller built up a fortune out of Standard Oil, he created a family office, which was essentially his wealth management offices. Wherever there have been wealth managers, they have been trying to figure out how to avoid taxation. What I would argue, though, it's the pace of this has accelerated. As wealth has concentrated in the hands of a few, as there are now, 2,300 global billionaires, these folks are, forming more family offices. In 1980, there were maybe 1,000 family offices. Now there are 10,000 family offices devoted to the purpose of family wealth preservation and transmission, meaning they're in the dynasty building business. Their goal is to help this wealth accelerate over generations, and that children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren will continue to have vast amounts of wealth. So there are now, I estimate, in the United States, 90,000 people who get up every morning and go to work with the goal of helping the rich get richer, stay richer, and build these dynastic families.
So they are the ones that help the rich directly to avoid paying, taxes. And then there's the ones that ensure that the rules remain rigged in favor of the rich by working in Washington, D.C. as lobbyists to pressure politicians to basically pass things like the 2017 tax reform bill.
Yeah. Think of them as a class unto themselves. Their interests is aligned with the very wealthy accumulating more. There's a sociologist, Jeffrey Winters at Northwestern, who has talked about what is an oligarchy. an oligarchy, in his definition, is different than just rich people, because oligarchs invest in the side of wealth, invest in wealth defense. They expend resources to defend their wealth. You know, maybe in the old days they hired mercenary armies to protect their land. Today they hire, you know, trust attorneys, and their institutional role is to buffer the oligarchs. And that's where you see wealth being used to create and protect more wealth. And it's fundamentally anti-democratic. It fundamentally threatens the stability of a democratic society and the ability of societies to tax and raise money. It creates another class, if you will, of wealthy, protected wealthy people.
Chuck, your book, The Wealth Hoarders, in exploring this wealth defense industry, did you get the chance in researching this book to actually talk to one or more of these people who help the billionaires to hide their trillions and thereby earn their own millions?
You know, I did. I talked to a number of people who had either worked in that space. I talked to several anonymously on the condition that I not share their names so that they could just explain, if you will, the secrets of the trade, the tools that they use in their wealth hiding toolbox. The role of the anonymous offshore bank account, shell companies like the shell companies in Delaware, trusts of various kind, grantor retained annuity trusts and dynasty trusts. These are all tools, and sometimes often they use all of those types of tools to create layers of protection that enable wealthy people to sort of hide their money for centuries indefinitely. But here's an interesting thing, Sonali. Some of these people are not happy. They actually recognize that, you know, while they might be helping a wealthy family, what they're doing is fundamentally not good for a healthy society. They see the same inequalities we see and are starting to question the occupation that they have. So I would say there's some interesting cracks opening up in that sector. And actually, I even met some wealth managers in the United Kingdom who are starting to say to their clients, we actually want to help you reduce your wealth, not accumulate more. We want you to, you know, help you move that money to solve some social problems and reduce your own fortunes. It's like a different way of looking at, they call it wealth minimization. So anyway, I think that, you know, and that and the fact that more and more people are waking up to the fact that there's this whole system. This isn't, by the way, a sort of sideshow. This is the system. This is the way the system is working now.
Now,
the wealthy people, the taxation has become optional at the very highest levels.
You've written and been quite critical of philanthropy as a way for billionaires to, you know, reduce their wealth because, of course, they get to set the agenda for what to fund and who to fund. And so this voluntary act of giving that is just nice PR for them. How do billionaires try to use philanthropy as a way to justify their money? And how should we shift the conversation from saying philanthropy is nice, but taxation is better because then we control that wealth and we get to have our elected officials deciding where it should go?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to realize as wealth is concentrated, the so has the power of charitable giving. Giving has become more top heavy as smaller givers and those who feel economically precarious are able to give less money. The super rich are the ones giving more and more. And billionaire philanthropy has emerged as a huge sector. And as you, just to underscore what you said, philanthropy may do some things that are useful, but it is not a substitute for a fair tax system and adequately funded public investments. And we should always remember, we as taxpayers subsidize this charitable giving. For every dollar that a billionaire gives to charity, we are chipping in 74 cents in lost tax revenue, or more in some cases. And so we have a public interest. This is taxpayer subsidized private philanthropy. And often these billionaires are using it as an extension of their power and influence to fund their pet causes, to fund their chairs at universities teaching their pet economic theories. It's not a healthy thing in a democratic society to have so much private wealth exercising so much power.
And of course, a lot of nonprofit organizations try to tailor their agenda, their asks, their goals to fit the funding priorities of the private foundations. And a lot of billionaires simply park their money into private foundations and don't even dispense most or all of it, right?
Yeah. You know, I think nonprofits are in a pickle because more and more they have to position themselves to get the big dollars. But we should, you know, here, even during this pandemic, you know, some foundations have stepped up, some philanthropists have given more, but there's a huge amount of wealth warehouse. There's about $1.2 trillion sitting in private foundations. There's another 120, 130 billion sitting in donor advised funds. These foundations are, these are intermediaries where wealthy people are basically warehousing their money. They get the tax break the moment they put the money into these funds, but then it can sit there. You know, foundations only have to pay out 5%, and that can include overhead, which can include paying fees to family members on the board. Donor advised funds have no required payout, even though the donor takes the full tax break. So we actually are advocates of something called the Emergency Charity Stimulus, which is to get Congress to mandate a higher payout or mandate any payout for donor advised funds. And I think that's a campaign that's really important right now because it begins to reform the philanthropy in a way that protects it, protects our democratic institutions and nonprofit sector from this top-heavy wealthy philanthropy.
Chuck, how do the billionaires benefit from anonymity? And how does this wealth defense industry help keep them anonymous? I mean, certainly there are some very well-known billionaires that we can all name, the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezoses and Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. But by and large, many of these people are unknowns. Why?
One of the things that we're finding is that while we tend to focus on these sort of high-tech fortunes that have, you know, kind of exploded in recent years, the United States has a wealth dynasty. We have hundreds of families that have persistently held on to hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars over multiple generations. And partly how they do that is by sequestering it, putting it into anonymous forms of ownership, keeping a low profile, avoiding taxation. And so you have a situation like, you know, the Mars family, which maybe, you know, in the 30s and 40s invented a successful candy bar. And maybe as recently as 1983, Forrest Mars had $1 billion, but now they have almost $100 billion in wealth. That wealth has grown. It's accelerated over the generations. And a lot of that's flying under the radar screen. Although some of those families use their wealth and power to lobby to get rid of taxes like the estate tax, our national inheritance tax. So you know, a lot of these corporations and shell companies are anonymous. And part of our work is to require transparency. You know, you shouldn't be able to create a corporation in the United States without having a beneficial owner, the real beneficiary and owner of that company named. It shouldn't be easier to do that than get a library card. You know, to get a library card, you have to say who you are and where you live. Same should be true for corporations.
Chuck, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can read your work, in addition to, of course, getting a copy of your latest book.
Yeah, actually, there's a website for the book called wealthhoarders.com. And you can find all our work at inequality.org, and we have a weekly newsletter that people can sign up for and learn, you know, about what they can do to reverse these extreme inequalities.
And we'll post links to both of those from our website later today. Chuck, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with the book, and always a pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Chuck Collins, Senior Scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. We've been discussing his latest book, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.